Welcome, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Law of Self-Defense. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for The Law of Self-Defense. Thank you all for being here, for joining us today. We have some interesting video to look at, actually two videos to look at. The second video, however, just as a fair warning, the second video is fairly bloody. So that portion, that late portion of today's show will be members only content. So if you're watching this on YouTube or X or Rumble, the more gory video, we'll end the stream on those open access platforms before we get the second video. But the first video is a armed robbery taking place at night in Philadelphia, where a man transporting $100,000 in cash in what appears to be just a car, finds himself the victim of an armed robbery. Gunshots are exchanged. In fact, quite a lot of gunshots are exchanged. And the question is, were all those gunshots lawful? The ones by the defender, obviously. The ones by the armed robber are clearly all unlawful. But were all the defender's shots lawful? That's what we'll be looking at today in this first video. And looking at defensive property law from Pennsylvania, where this occurred, but also contrasting and comparing with use of force law from Florida, from Texas, which has very different defensive property laws. And that'll be what we'll be covering today. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead and start the formal launch of today's show. All right, so this is what we're covering today. I forgot to have it ready, sorry. This armed robbery event in the city of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia. And there's a handgun in that gentleman's hand. He's the armed robber. He does, by the way, manage to shoot his victim, and the victim still manages to return fire. So bad news and good news there. Before we jump into the meat of the matter, I do want to remind everybody, because it is coming up super quick, this Saturday, just days away, Saturday, April 20th, we're holding one of our rare, only twice a year, live Law of Self-Defense advanced classes. This is a full day live course taught live by me, streamed to you at your computer, where I teach you everything you need to know in order for you to be hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, your property. We cover defense of yourself, of course. We cover defense of others, family, neighbors, colleagues, even strangers, like an active shooter event. We cover defense of property, everything from highly defensible property like your home all the way down to least defensible property, which includes your pets, by the way. Your pets are least defensible property, believe it or not. We cover interacting with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event. We spend almost an hour on that topic alone because it's a lot more subtle than most people think. And we're teaching you how to think about these use of force issues. Now, we only teach this class twice a year. If you miss this one, it'll be October before you have the opportunity again. Don't wait. You don't know when you'll be attacked. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack, not you. You need to have this insight expertise on board before the fight happens. It doesn't help you afterwards. By the way, if you have a conflict on Saturday, April 20th, I would urge you to register anyway, because we'll make the playback version of that class available to all the registered students for 2 weeks after the live class. So you can watch it at your leisure over that 2 week period. And today is the last day to get up to 50% off your registration at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. And when you go to that webpage, you'll see we have a list of more than 100 very specific use of force law questions we answer over the course of the day in plain English. And because it's live, there's plenty of opportunity for live Q&A as well. All of that and more this Saturday, April 20th. Join me. Spend the day with me at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. All right. So This Philadelphia event was brought to my attention by Twitter, as so many things are. Here's Steve Keeley, Fox 29, which I presume is a local Philly Fox News station, says, driver targeted in attempted robbery, was transporting $100,000 in cash. This was a Philly police sources tell me this was a planned robbery. Detective sources believe no money was taken. The driver, 31, is licensed to carry and pulled gun. He was shot in the chest. He fires back, and there's a part two to this tweet. A driver working for Fast Cash Company in Willow Grove had passenger co-worker not licensed to carry gun and not hurt in shooting. Philly police believe attempted holdup at stoplight on Friday 9:40 p.m. was planned, had to know they had $100,000. The whole dynamic feels kind of weird, right? I mean, if you're going to rob somebody who has $100,000, I would presume they have a gun. I'm not sure I'd approach them in this manner. By the way, if you're carrying $100,000 in a car, that passenger, they need a long gun. What are they there for if they're not going to be able to help you? Unarmed. Did they know they were sitting on $100,000 and that they were a ripe target to be an armed robbery victim? So let's talk a little bit about use of force law in the context of this kind of armed robbery scenario. So we have at least, arguably three use of force rationales here. One is defense of persons, which is two-part, defense of yourself and defense of others. So the driver is defending himself from an imminent threat of deadly force harm, an imminent unlawful threat of deadly force harm at the hands of this armed robber who's pointing a gun at him. Arguably, he's also defending the passenger in the car, so he's a defense of others argument as well. Both of those are defense of persons claims, and the legal question there is, do the defenders have these five elements present? Innocence, imminence, proportionality, avoidance, and reasonableness. And certainly, when we're at this point, of the confrontation, you're being held at gunpoint by an armed robber. Are you the innocent party? Yes, clearly the armed robber is the unlawful aggressor. Is the threat against you imminent, meaning is it actually taking place or immediately about to happen? Well, I mean, kind of both, right? The muzzle's on you, so that's actually taking place. The gunshot that would cause you injury is immediately about to happen. This is not some past threat. This didn't happen the day before, and then you decided to use force the following day. This is not some speculative future threat. This guy didn't say, I'm going to go home and get a gun and come back here and commit armed robbery of you. This is an imminent threat at the moment caught in this image. Proportionality. What's the intensity of force you're defending yourself against? Well, you're defending yourself against deadly force, force readily capable of causing death or serious bodily injury. Assuming the other elements of self-defense are satisfied, that privileges you to use deadly force in self-defense, but only for as long as the other elements of self-defense are present. Avoidance has to do with whether or not there's a legal duty to retreat before you can use deadly force in self-defense. There's only 11 duty to retreat states. Pennsylvania is not one of them, although Pennsylvania's stand your ground law is kind of odd. Although it would be, stand your ground would be triggered under these circumstances. But in any case, even in a duty to retreat state, you only have that duty when it's possible for you to retreat with complete safety. Held at gunpoint, you're not outrunning a bullet, even if you're in a car. You're not outdriving a bullet. So there is no feasible, completely safe means of retreat here. Therefore, you wouldn't have that legal duty of avoidance, even in a duty to retreat state at this moment in the video, under these circumstances. And then reasonableness. Did the defender have a subjective good faith belief in the need to act in self-defense? We don't have mind reading machines, but one would expect that's what he would say. And is that subjective, genuine good faith belief objectively reasonable? Would a hypothetical, reasonable, and prudent person in his circumstances, the defender's circumstances, share that subjective belief that they're facing an imminent deadly force threat? Right? I think clearly that's the case, based on this image of the event. So when this is happening, when he's being actively threatened by a gun, in fact, he's shot in the chest once, so he's shot and hit. when he's being actively threatened with the gun, all the elements of self-defense are satisfied for the defender, and the use of deadly defensive force would be justified. The problem is, it's not justified forever. It's justified for the period of time in which those elements remain satisfied. And in particular, we're focused here on the element of imminence. So, are you facing a threat that's actually occurring or immediately about to occur? Now, prior to this going off, this armed robbery being initiated, presumably the driver is just driving along. There's no threat at all, so there's no imminent threat. Then this happens. This dude jumps out of his car with the gun in hand, points it at the defender. Now there's an imminent threat of harm. The window of imminence is opened. Assuming the other elements of self-defense are satisfied, now the driver is privileged to use deadly force to defend himself from this armed robbery attack. But what happens when the window of imminence closes? What happens when there's no longer an imminent threat of unlawful force against the defender? Well, then the window of imminence closes and the privilege to use deadly defensive force has ended. Does that happen here? And if it does happen here, does this defender continue to use deadly defensive force after the window of imminence is closed? Well, let's go to the videotape, which is here somewhere. Okay. I'll make myself small. Anybody remember the old Steve Martin skit where he talks about getting small, driving his car with a big steering wheel? You have to be of a certain age, I guess. All right, let's go ahead and play this clip. So the first half of this video is the action, and then the second half is like some police screenshots and other things they're hoping will help the public help them capture this armed robber. But we'll watch that as well. Here we go. So there's, by the way, I should mention, there's no audio here. So you can't hear the gunshots go off. This looks like it was captured on a civilian dash camera. I guess there was no audio capability. In any case, I don't have the audio for it. So I did embed in the screen when I think gunshots are taking place on the right side of the screen for the armed robber and the left side of the screen for the defender. And that's based on things like smoke in the air, sometimes a muzzle flash. I'm guessing a little bit, but I think I've got it pretty close. So look for the bangs. Right side will be the bad guy shooting. Left side will be the good guy shooting. So here comes the bad guy. Gun up. Crappy grip. That's good. Oh, backing up. Two shots by the bad guy, it looks like. Gets back in his car. He's driving away. And here come the good guy shots. It looks to me like there's eight of those. So here's the bad guy, right? Imminent deadly force threat. Clearly, he's walking up. I presume he sees the driver, the good guy, attempting to present his gun. That's what scares him back right here. It looks to me like he fires his shots while he's in flight back to his own car, but still pointing the gun back over, behind him towards the driver, one-handed now. Because of his the position of his body while he's running back to his car, fires the two shots, and one of these shots at least hits the defender in the chest. So now he's getting back into his car. And I just want to point out a couple of things. So first of all, if you look here in the upper left of the image, you can see reflected off the inside of the windshield, a hand, presumably of the driver of the vehicle. And I just want to note that, look at that hand. It's just twiddling. Here comes the bad guy. Here's his gun. That hand is still twiddling. So this is 5 seconds into this video. Bad guy's walking up. Bad guy's walking 6 seconds. Driver's door opens up, so now you're going to have a second aggressor. Now, 7 seconds in, the hand begins moving. 8 seconds, it's out of sight in the windshield. So 3 seconds from when the bad guy's got the muzzle up on your windshield and your hand starts moving. Folks, if you're sitting on $100,000 cash in a passenger vehicle, that hand needs to start moving as soon as you see that car door in front of you crack open. 3 seconds is forever. By the way, if you had seen it 3 seconds earlier, might you have had options? Maybe put it in reverse and try to back away before you're at muzzle point. At least begin to get your gun out. If you're sitting on $100,000, that gun, that defensive gun, better be damn accessible. And in 3 seconds, how many rounds can you fire? I mean, even someone not really trying could fire 0.2 seconds splits. That's 5 rounds a second. That's a barrage of fire. 15 rounds in 3 seconds. But the bad guy gets all the way up here. And this is probably one of the reasons the good guy got shot. Bad guy's all the way up here. And only then is he alarmed. So now we're fully 8, almost 9 seconds in. Bad guy is reconsidering his poor life choices. But he's close enough now that even as he's running back, right there, he fires a shot, one-handed, pointing backwards as he's running in the opposite direction. And I believe there's another shot right there, another muzzle blast. Again, running backwards away from the defender. But he still manages to get a hit because he got that close. Anybody believes he's got a front sight focus here? Nope, he's just point shooting. But because he's close, it's good enough to get a chest hit on the defender. Now he stopped shooting. He jumps back in his car. The car takes off. And now we're at 15 seconds. So from when he jumps back into his car, I mean, he fires his last shot right there. That's at 9 seconds. So 6 seconds later is how long it takes for this defender to bring his own gun into play, which would be a problem if this armed robber had been more aggressive, right? He could have done a mag dump into the windshield too. And the good guy apparently was going to take 6 seconds. 6 seconds, 5 rounds a second. That's, in theory, 30 seconds the bad guy could have put into the good guy before the good guy was in a position to defend himself. The real problem, of course, is here the car's already begun driving away before the good guy fires even his first shot. This is at 14 seconds. First shot's at 15 seconds. And then as it's driving away, the good guy fires a barrage of shots, roughly 0.2 seconds splits. 7, 8, I think that's the last one. So 8 rounds in 3 seconds. So longer than 0.2 seconds splits, obviously, if you do the math. The trouble is, where's the threat against persons here? Where are those 5 elements of self-defense? How is the people in this car, how are the people in the bad guy's car still presenting as an imminent deadly force threat to the victim of the armed robbery? Is there a defense of self argument here, or a defense of others argument for the pointless passenger in the good guy's car? And to the extent you're just sending rounds down the street, there's other people down here. It's only 9:30 at night. There's cars on the road. Where are those rounds going? Do we really believe that with a bullet to the chest firing at this rate, at this distance, that the good guy is putting all those rounds into the back window of that fleeing car? Or the rounds just screaming down the street? And remember, bullets don't miss, folks. They may not hit the intended target, but they keep going until they hit something. If this isn't justifiable self-defense, it's just felony reckless endangerment to be sending a barrage of 8 rounds down the street. And unfortunately, I don't see an ongoing imminent threat here for at least some of these rounds. Nobody's leaning out of this car as it's driving away, firing shots back at the defender. Now, I did mention we have a second video that I want to share with all of you, and that is this video. This is an armed robbery in a convenience store. Came to my attention on Twitter yesterday as well. Also involves a barrage of fire by the good guy defender. But the circumstances are sufficiently different that this barrage of fire is almost certainly legally justified, whereas this barrage of fire almost certainly is not legally justified. So, does that mean the defender here is some kind of malicious bad actor? No. He's probably the most common thing in the world. He's probably a well-intentioned, good guy who thinks that he's allowed to do this, who thinks that this conduct falls within the legal boundaries for self-defense. After all, someone just shot him in the chest. Isn't he allowed to shoot back? Unfortunately, if his argument is defense of persons, self-defense or defense of others, it looks to me like at least the element of imminence is gone. The window of imminence has closed, and therefore the defender's legal privilege to use force in self-defense has closed. Now, defense of persons, of course, is not the only argument available here. There's potentially a defense of property argument. So we could take a look at Pennsylvania's defense of property statute. Let me make that bigger so we can actually see it. Chapter 5 of Pennsylvania statutes. General principles of justification. So justification, self-defense would be a justification. Defense of property is a justification, meaning these are legal defenses of confession and avoidance. So you're confessing to the underlying conduct. I shot at that guy to defend myself. I shot at that guy to defend my property. I concede that. I'm not denying that. But even though I concede to that underlying conduct, that's the basis for the criminal charge against me, whether it's murder or manslaughter or reckless endangerment or aggravated battery with a firearm. That I should nevertheless be free of legal liability because the conduct was justified, meets the conditions of self-defense, which this really doesn't, or defense of others, or meets the conditions for defense of property. Now, Pennsylvania has a fairly typical defense of property structure, particularly in the context of defense of personal property. And the rule is that although there are circumstances in which you can use force in defense of property, there are no circumstances, personal property, there are no circumstances under Pennsylvania law where you can use deadly force in defense of personal property in the absence of a threat to persons. And if there's a threat to persons, it's not really a defense of property scenario anymore. It's a defense of persons scenario. So what do we have? Use of justifiable force to protect property. Now, we do need to distinguish personal property, which I would classify as least protectable property under Pennsylvania law and really the law of every state except for Texas. And we'll get to Texas in a moment. Personal property, only non-deadly force in defense of personal property in the absence of a threat to persons. There is highly defensible property, like your home, for example, sometimes a place of business, sometimes an occupied vehicle also qualifies as highly defensible property where you do get special provisions for the use of deadly force in the context of defense of highly defensible property that you do not have in the context of the defense of least defensible property. But here we're talking cash money. That's personal property. And it's a lot of cash money. But the defense of property law doesn't say you get to go to deadly force in defense of personal property if it's valuable. It doesn't list a dollar amount. It doesn't matter how valuable it is. If you're using deadly force in defense of personal property in any state but Texas, it's going to be unlawful. So, Section 507, use of force justifiable for protection of property. The use of force upon or toward the person of another is justifiable when the actor believes such force is immediately necessary. And this combines interference with personal property, what they call tangible property here, and trespass on open land. I'm only going to address the tangible, movable property issue relevant to this video. It's justifiable when immediately necessary to prevent or terminate the unlawful carrying away of tangible, movable property if such movable property is believed by the actor to be in his possession or in the possession of another person for whose protection he acts, or to affect or retake tangible, movable property if you believe the person who's taken it is not taking it under authority and some other conditions. That's not occurring here, right? The cash wasn't taken and the owner is trying to retake it. The good guy's trying to retake it. In fact, the armed robbery was never successful, was never successfully executed. It was defeated before the desired property could be seized. Limitations on justifiable use of force. The use of force is justifiable under this section only, this is always a good one, some states have this provision, if the defender first requests the person against whom such force is used to desist from his interference with the property. So first you're expected to ask the other person to stop. Well, the reason they have this kind of provision is because they're concerned about innocent takers. So you can imagine you're in a restaurant that has like a common coat rack. You hang your coat up there like everybody else has on a cold day. And some other patron of the restaurant has a coat that looks very similar to yours, maybe identical to yours. Maybe you both shop at Costco. And he accidentally takes your coat and is walking out with it. You recognize it as your coat because of a unique coffee stain on it or whatever reason. Before you use force upon him to recover your property, they want you to request that he stop what he's doing. So maybe we can prevent this unintentional taking with a simple verbal request. But you're not required to make the request if such a request would be useless or it would be dangerous to yourself. Obviously, under these circumstances, it would be dangerous to yourself. Let's see. Let me scroll. Here we get to it. Subsection I here. The use of deadly force is justifiable as defensive property if there has been an entry into the actor's dwelling. So the use of deadly force is restricted to highly defensible property, your castle. So someone's made an entry into your dwelling. The entry is not lawful. And the defender reasonably believes that force less than deadly force would be adequate to terminate the entry. But the only context under Pennsylvania law in which deadly force in defense of property would be permissible would be in the context of your dwelling, of your home, of your castle. Not your $100,000 in cash in the car with you. And I think that's all I wanted to cover there. So in the absence of a threat to persons in this video, which occurred in Pennsylvania, there is no legal justification for the use of deadly force against that person who was just committing an armed robbery. What about other states? Let's take a look at Florida. This is Florida's general self-defense statute, 776.012. And it's interesting because it has a generalized catch-all forcible felony provision. The first paragraph here is the use of non-deadly force in self-defense, but we're interested here in the use of deadly force in self-defense. Paragraph 2. A person is justified in using or threatening to use deadly force if he reasonably believes using or threatening to use such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or another, or to prevent imminent commission of a forcible felony. So we have the defense of persons. And all the elements are in that sentence, if you know to look for them. And then we have this catch-all to prevent a forcible felony. Imminent commission of a forcible felony. What is a forcible felony under Florida law? Well, we have a statute for that, 776.08. Forcible felony means treason, murder, manslaughter, sexual battery, carjacking, home invasion robbery, burglary, arson, kidnapping, aggravated assault, aggravated battery, aggravated stalking, aircraft piracy, unlawful throwing, placing, or discharging of a destructive device or bomb, or any other felony which involves the use or threat of physical force or violence against any individual. Now, when you look at this, obviously they list robbery as a forcible felony. We have a robbery taking place in this video, an aggravated robbery, a felony robbery, robbery with a deadly weapon with threat of deadly force harm. But if you look at these forcible felonies, what do they all have in common? They're all really threats to persons, right? So carjacking is different than car theft because it requires the car's occupied. There's people in the car. That's really what's being protected. Arson, you may think of as a property crime. You're burning property. But it's treated as a crime against persons because of the uncontrollable nature of fire and the risk that there's people inside the dwelling. So traditionally, deadly force is permitted to prevent the imminent commission of an arson. And then the last portion here kind of gives it away, or any other felony which involves the use or threat of physical force or violence against any individual. So really, these are defense of person provisions. I mean, we think of robbery as a property crime, but robbery is different than theft, because theft is just the taking of some piece of property that doesn't belong to you, conversion of its use to your use without authority or permission. Robbery is taking property with threat against the person, right? By threat of force or violence against that other party. So really, it's a threat to person's act, and defending against robbery is a defense of person's defense, legal defense. But we don't have any of that in this video while this car is driving away. I mean, there is no armed robbery occurring anymore. And the Florida catch-all for forcible felony says the imminent commission of a forcible felony, not flight from a forcible felony. What about another state? Texas. Texas is the interesting state, the only one that allows for the use of deadly force in defense of even mere personal property. Now, there are a lot of loopholes that need to be jumped through. I will say I have seen this statute used to justify the use of an effective use, actual killing, the use of deadly defensive force to defend mere personal property in the complete absence of a threat to persons, and have it be completely justified. I know of a case where a husband and wife were out to dinner. They were walking down the street, coming back from the restaurant, and some dude walks up and grabs the wife's necklace and rips it clean off her neck and just starts running down the street. And the husband just pulls his pistol, takes aim, shoots, kills that guy, drops him right there. They recover the necklace. They call the police. They explain what happened. And the cops say, well, if that guy didn't want to get shot dead, he shouldn't have stolen the necklace. Because the conditions for the use of deadly force in defense of mere personal property were satisfied under those circumstances. Let's take a look at what those conditions are. So deadly force to protect property, and we're talking here about just personal property, items, undeveloped land, things like that. Least defensible property, by the way, which includes your pets. Your pets are least defensible property. I know you feel like your pets are members of your family, just like the humans in your family, maybe more so, depending on the humans in your family. But legally, they're just personal property. Now, of course, this Texas provision that allows for the use of deadly force in defense of personal property would also, in Texas, apply to your pets. A person is justified in using deadly force against another to protect land, or, and they mean open undeveloped land here. They don't mean land like your home. Your home would have a different, as highly defensible property, would have a different standard for the use of deadly defensive force. To protect land or tangible movable property, so personal property, first you have to meet all the conditions for the use of non-deadly force in defense of property. This is Texas Penal Code 9.42. Deadly force to protect property. 9.41 referenced here is non-deadly force in defense of property. So first you have to read 9.41, make sure you meet all those conditions. If you do, then you also have to meet these additional conditions for deadly defensive force. When and to the degree he reasonably believes that deadly force is immediately necessary to prevent the other's imminent commission of arson, burglary, robbery, aggravated robbery, theft during the nighttime, or criminal mischief during the nighttime. So this would be satisfied, right? Because we have, well, we have an aggravated robbery here, which is enumerated. Even a simple robbery would be sufficient. Or to prevent the other who was fleeing immediately after committing burglary, robbery, aggravated robbery, or theft during the nighttime from escaping with the property. Now, this is an interesting question because, of course, there was an attempt aggravated robbery. And now the robber is fleeing, but did he commit the robbery? Is he fleeing after commission of the robbery? I mean, you could argue it both ways. One is that, well, yeah, you commit the robbery even if you're unsuccessful in the robbery, right? You're, at least it's an attempt, although this doesn't say attempt. Now, clearly, if this robber had seized the $100,000 and was running away with it, well, that would qualify under this paragraph as well. And the defender would have to believe that the property cannot be protected by any other means. Well, you're facing a gun here, so what other means would you use? and the use of force other than deadly force would expose the defender to substantial risk of death or serious bodily injury. So all of this would be satisfied, I would argue. The only question is, can you still do it while the robber, the unsuccessful robber, is in flight? I think that's an open question here. Problematic. All right, so just wanted to share with you, Pennsylvania defense property law, show you how Florida is a little bit different and Texas is quite a bit different. Now, I'm going to turn to the Q&A at this point. First, of course, for our law of self-defense members, and then I'll take a look at the Q&A in YouTube. But if you have a question or comment in YouTube that you'd like me to address, it needs to be a minimum $10 super chat. Law of self-defense members get all their questions answered for free. It's dirt cheap to be a law of self-defense member. And by the way, in just after we do this Q&A, I have a second video to share with all of you. I mentioned it at the start, this convenience store robbery shootout in which the defending security guard puts a lot of rounds into this bad guy here. A lot of them. Sounds like 8 or 10 or 12 over a sustained period of time. And probably every one of those rounds is perfectly justified, as opposed to what we just saw in the armed robbery scenario. But because this video is gory, and I don't want YouTube to get mad at me, the open stream versions of today's live stream, we will cut off the YouTube, Twitter, and Rumble feeds when we get to that video, and it'll just be for law self-defense members on the member dashboard. So the good news is dirt cheap to be a law self-defense member. You can become one right now. Try it out for 2 weeks for just 99 cents, folks. 2 week trial membership, lawofselfdefense.com/trial. You can do that right now. Just open up another tab in your browser and you'll be emailed directions for how to join us for the remainder of today's show. And of course, you get all your questions answered for free when you put them in the member chat on the member dashboard, lawofselfdefense.com/trial. And after the 2 weeks, it's still dirt cheap. It's only about 30 cents a day, less than $10 a month, folks, to be a law of self-defense member. Less than asking one question on YouTube. So I definitely would not recommend the super chat route. I would at least try it out for 2 weeks or 99 cents. lawofselfdefense.com/trial. All right, let's take a look at the member. I thought about putting in a sound effect for the gunshots in that armed robbery video. You know, donut operator puts in duck quacks for the gunshots. But I didn't have time before the show started. All right, let's see what we have. Gene says the passenger in the victim's car, the defendant's car, was the one who told his buddies to do the robbery. Well, somebody did, right? I mean, I think it's only reasonable to infer that this car with $100,000 in cash in it was not selected at random on a Philadelphia street. Somebody knew. Let's see. And by the way, you should presume that you got $100,000 in cash in your car, somebody's going to know. Let's see. Sheepdog in Virginia says he should not have fired when he did. Yeah, I mean, this happens a lot, by the way. In otherwise lawful cases of self-defense, where there is an imminent unlawful deadly force threat to the defender, so the window of imminence is opened, and then the defender begins to think about how he wants to respond. First of all, he has to notice the event, right? Like we saw here, there was like 3 seconds before the defender responded at all to someone pointing a muzzle at him from just a few feet away. First, he has to perceive the threat. Then he has to, you know, process that perception. Then he has to decide what I'm going to do now. And if you're someone who hasn't really thought this out ahead of time, there can be quite a bit of hesitation. So it's almost like the wheels in their head don't have traction. They're just spinning in the mud, right? And then suddenly they gain traction and the defender begins to act in defense. But if there's enough of a delay, you can lose that window of imminence. Now, I always tell people, don't get into fights you don't need to get into. Use the minimum amount of force that's consistent with your safety. But if you're going to use force defensively, doing it in an expedited manner while the window of imminence is still open is what's required for that use of force to be lawful. So getting to the defensive force quick can prevent you from ending up using that force outside that defensive window. Now, of course, if you do miss the window, if the window of eminence closes, then you have to be able to recognize that your privilege to use defensive force has also ended with the closing of that window. Let's see. Jeffrey says, the attacker had some luck to hit him. Front window is tough to know where the bullets will go, even with training, shooting through windows. Yeah, I've shot through quite a few car windshields in training programs. In my opinion, you never really know where that round's going to go. So to that extent, there was quite a bit of luck here. Of course, you know, you completely miss the windshield, you're missing the car, then you're definitely not getting a hit. Once a especially a handgun round, goes through any kind of barrier between you and the target, I think you have very little predictability about where that round's going to end up. Sheepdog in Virginia says, could he claim that due to his gunshot wound, he was not thinking clearly and was behind on his timing of shooting back? Yeah, I would make that argument. I mean, there's always some delay in response, right? Because action beats reaction. And I have seen cases where, you know, if you watch a shooting on video and it's obvious, for example, the victim of the shooting, of the defender's gunshot, was the unlawful aggressor in the fight, and the defender lawfully goes to his gun and brings it to bear and makes the decision to shoot. But the bad guy also sees the gun in the defender's hand now and begins to flinch and turn away from the muzzle and ends up getting shot in the back. Because there's a small delay, maybe 6/10, 7/10 of a second between the decision to pull the trigger, even when you have the gun aligned, and when the gun actually goes off. Maybe it's shorter than that, depending on how prepared the defender is, but 6 or 7/10 of a second would not be unusual. And the human body can turn quite a bit, right? Spin around quite a bit in that time. So the bullet was aimed at the front of the aggressor, but it ends up hitting the aggressor in the back. Well, of course, if you shoot someone in the back at your leisure, that begins to not look like self-defense. But if it's within that narrow reaction delay time frame, then it's explainable. Here, this is a much longer time, right? This is several seconds. But if I were the defender, certainly I would argue in his behalf, listen, my reaction time was, and my perception of events was impaired because that dude just shot me in the chest. And he owns that impairment. He caused that. Like if someone gave you a blow to the head, knocked your glasses off, right? Stunned you. Yeah, that can affect your decision-making, but that's on him. He did that to you. Robert asks, if the defender were a platinum member of Law of Self-Defense, those are the only people who qualify for me to provide a legal consult on the use of force event. We don't take outside consults anymore. We haven't for a couple of years. You need to be a Law of Self-Defense platinum member if you'd like me to be part of your defense team, should the worst happen. What arguments would you marshal to justify the gunshots at the moving vehicle? Largely what I just outlined. Let's see. Zakuza says, the way Branca broke it down would be exactly how a prosecutor would present it. Yeah, right. I'd say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this defendant was the victim of a terrible crime, armed robbery. And while that armed robbery was in progress, he had every right in the world to use deadly force to save his life. But once he was no longer subject to the armed robbery, his privilege to send rounds down our Philadelphia streets was over. And he did it anyway. And that's just not lawful. Let's see. Zakuza says, this is a great case to point out how having a charismatic lawyer that can tell a story is important. Yeah, storytelling is everything in court, right? And being able to, before you get to court, hopefully, when you're getting charges dismissed, the reason you're getting them dismissed is you're presenting to the prosecution the compelling story that you're prepared to share with the jury. And that gets difficult for the prosecutor to overcome. If you have a compelling story of self-defense, remember that the burden's on the state to disprove self-defense, not by a majority, but beyond any reasonable doubt. A compelling narrative story of innocence is how you do that. And the threat of being able to do that is what deters prosecutors from bringing you to trial or even charging you in the first place because you've made yourself hard to convict. One of the many things we teach in the course of our full-day Law Self-Defense Advanced course taking place this Saturday. Next one's not till October. Folks, don't miss this one. Let's see. Yeah, Phil says, two of Cooper's seven principles of personal defense relating directly to imminence are decisiveness and speed. Yeah, I actually have that book. I can see it from here. It's on the bookshelf across my office, the other side of my monitors. Great book. I think you can still get it from Amazon. Frankly, if you don't have all of Cooper's books, you're doing it wrong. But yeah, decisiveness and speed. One of the reasons we teach the law of self-defense as we do is not just to help people win the legal fight, but because where I see most good guy cases of self-defense get in trouble at the tactical level is because of ambiguity in the situation and their own hesitancy. Because no normal law-abiding person wants to have to shoot somebody, cause them harm, and then incur all the terrible legal risk that follows. So often there's hesitancy, and one of the reasons we produce this kind of content most days of the week, breaking down these videos of use of force events, is to expose and condition all of you to these kinds of scenarios. You know, we can't prepare you for every theoretical variable in the use of force event, but they're not really infinitely variable, are they? I mean, most armed robberies tend to look kind of the same, right? They're either non-deadly armed robberies, strong arm robberies, or they're deadly force armed robberies. And by getting exposed to the generalized categories of typical situations where you might be compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, your property, you are conditioning yourself, preparing yourself cognitively for reacting decisively when you find yourself, heaven forbid, in one of those scenarios. It's the same way pilots learn about crashes, right? It's not by undergoing their own crashes. That would be a very inefficient way to learn. They study other pilots' crashes and learn from them. We can learn from watching other people's use of force events, and that's a large part of what we do, because then, heaven forbid, you find yourself the victim of an armed robbery. It's not the first time you've thought about it. You've mentally, virtually been in that position scores or hundreds of times before, depending on how long you've been a law self-defense member. And you're prepared to act decisively in winning the physical battle as well as the legal battle. Sheepdog in VA says, as a law enforcement officer, I see these types of things a lot. People aren't paying attention to the surroundings and place themselves at more risk of harm because of it, especially carrying $100,000 in cash. You should be constantly scanning for threats. Yeah, I'm not sure how you don't just have a gun in hand when you're sitting on $100,000. All right, that's all the member Q&A. Let's take a look at, see if there's any super chats. Again, folks, I don't encourage the super chats. I would encourage you to be a law self-defense member. Super chats have to be $10 to get answered. Members get their questions answered for free. 2-week trial membership, 99 cents, folks. I know you have 99 cents. And that'll let you stay with us for the remainder of the show as we go into that second video I talked about. Let's see. By the way, we just broke 63,000 subscribers. If you are watching on YouTube, a subscribe and a thumbs up would be greatly appreciated. Let's see. Yep, doesn't look like there's any super chats. Hopefully, all the people who would have done $10 super chats are instead becoming law self-defense members for less than $10 a month. That would be the prudent thing to do. All right, so before I jump into the next video, just a reminder, this Saturday, any of you old enough to remember the old race car advertisements they put on the radio? Saturday, come to Tony's Racetrack. This Saturday, full day course taught live by me, streamed to you at your computer, law self-defense advanced class, everything you need to know to make yourself hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, the property. Today is the last day for 50% off registration. Don't delay until tomorrow and pay 100%, folks. That's just silly. LawSelfDefense.com/advanced. We only teach this class twice a year. It'll be, I think it's October 19th before we get to it again. Yep. Don't wait till October 19th. You don't know if you're going to be attacked between now and then, right? It's not up to you when you're attacked. It's up to the bad guy. Join us on Saturday. And if you have a conflict for Saturday, register anyway at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced, because we'll make the playback of the class available to all the registered students for 2 weeks after the event. So you can watch it at your leisure over that 2 week period. Or better yet, be there live. If you're there live, it's a lot more fun because we have plenty of opportunity for live Q&A. Again, that's at lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. Now I'm going to turn to this video, but because of the gory nature, that means that I am signing off from the YouTube, Rumble, and Twitter streams. So I'm going to play the little exit video. If you're a Law of Self-Defense member, don't go anywhere right now. I'll be back in just about 8 seconds. If you are here as a free participant on YouTube, Rumble, or Twitter, however, this is where the show ends for you. Thanks for joining us, but we'll see you next time. I wasn't quick enough. YouTube's gone. Twitter's gone. And now Rumble. And now it's just us Law of Self-Defense members. So let's take a look. This, now, caution, caution, caution. There's it's not super gory, but there is blood visible in this video. So if you're uncomfortable with that, that's why I'm not live open streaming it. If you're uncomfortable with that, you know, now might be a good time to exit. Of course, I became aware of this on Twitter. Mr. Guns and Gear, that's a great follow on Twitter, writes, a man is told to leave a gas station by a security guard. He was apparently grilling in the parking lot and had been asked to leave multiple times. The man pulls a gun. The security guard engages with a lot of gunfire. The man fires back, hitting the security guard in the thigh. I don't have the rest of it here, but I read it earlier. The man is taken to the hospital. I don't think he makes it. Let me double check that. See if I have this right here. Hopefully I bookmarked it. Yes, the man is taken to the hospital. Oh, come on. Something's wrong with Twitter. That's not correct. Try it again. It's not opening it up for me. Man is taken to the hospital and dies. Not surprising given the volume of fire. Security guard is expected to be fine and is not facing charges. At least not yet, and probably won't. And this was also from Philadelphia, by the way. All right, so let's go ahead and jump into this video, the actual video. I'll make myself small again. There is audio here. We'll run through it. It's about 38 seconds long, and then we'll break it down. Here we go.
Who the fuck are you talking to? No, don't fucking touch me, dog. Who the fuck are you talking to, dog? Like, really?
And that's it. Okay. So let's rewind to the beginning. Starts here. Let's presume this guy knows he's not supposed to be in the gas station. We saw reported on Twitter. He'd been told before to leave. He's coming in. And the security guard's been told not to let this guy in. So the security guard puts his hand out. You can't come in. Right there. I'll make it big again so it's easier to see. Is the security guard allowed to do that? Is he allowed to use non-deadly force to prevent what's effectively a trespass here? Yes, he's allowed to do that. He's acting on behalf of the property owner. This guy's not allowed on the property without permission. He's been told he doesn't have permission. He's committing a trespass. And the guard's allowed to simply prevent him from entering. Put a hand on him. The guy doesn't like it. Don't put your hands on me. And what's he do? He gets all angry and he whips out a gun. First of all, he shoves back against the guard. Is he allowed to do that? Is a trespasser authorized, privileged to use force against this security guard? No. So he's just committed a battery on the security guard. A simple battery, misdemeanor. But that's not good enough. He decides he doesn't like how he's being spoken to, so he's going to whip out his gat. Gets a gun out. Now, you think he intends to shoot the security guard? Probably not, really. I mean, he would have just shot him, I guess, if he intended to shoot him. But is he nevertheless presenting as an imminent threat of unlawful deadly force harm? The five elements of self-defense. Is the trespasser the unlawful initial aggressor here? Yeah, he is. The security guard arguably used force first when he put his hand on the trespasser, but that's not unlawful force. That doesn't make him an unlawful aggressor. This guy is the initial unlawful aggressor, both when he shoves the security guard and when he now whips out this gat for the purpose of changing the security guard's behavior. So he's both an unlawful non-deadly force aggressor, right? The shoving of the security guard. And now he's an unlawful deadly force initial aggressor, which also covers the element of proportionality. The security guard's not facing merely non-deadly force as a threat. He's facing deadly force as a threat. Is that threat imminent? Well, certainly the now aggravated assault with a deadly weapon is actually taking place. And of course, if someone's got a gun out in a threatening manner towards you, it only takes an instant for them to actually bring the gun in use against you. So it's an imminent threat. Avoidance, there's no... I mentioned earlier during the public stream that Pennsylvania has a weird stand your ground statute. And I forgot to expand on that, but I'll do it now. In Pennsylvania, you have the right to stand your ground, but it's conditioned, among other things, on the fact that you were facing some kind of apparent... Sorry, folks. That you were facing some kind of apparent deadly weapon. So if you're not facing an apparent deadly weapon, you do have a legal duty to retreat before you can use deadly force in self-defense. Now, of course, there's many ways in which you can be threatened with deadly force without the other guy having a weapon, right? He could be much larger than you. There could be a disparity of force situation. But then you would have a legal duty to retreat under Pennsylvania law, unless he presents a deadly weapon. Of course, in this case, the trespasser does prevent a deadly weapon. So that would privilege the guard to stand his ground. There may be other rationales for standing his ground too, right? He's an agent of the property owner, so he's got a right to be there. But in any case, it wouldn't apply because the bad guy here has whipped out a gun. So avoidance is off the table. And is the security guard reasonably perceiving this deadly force threat? Does he have a subjective good faith belief that he's facing a deadly force threat? And is he reasonably perceiving it? And the answer to that is yes. I mean, he sees the gun, right? And in fact, it is a gun because the guard gets shot. Then we have that fusillade of gunshots. I'll play it from right here. I can't even count how many shots there are. And one or two of them are shots by the bad guy. I think when he's on the ground, because one of those hits the security guard in the leg. But it's a fusillade of shots, so many shots, ultimately fatal to the trespasser. Can they all be justified? Let's run through that part again.
What are you talking to, dog? Like, really?
All right. I love it when he goes, really. You know what I think? Speculating a little bit here, but I think this trespasser, I think his life experience is you can whip a gun out and wave it around as just a show of bravado. And that's acceptable in his circles. And then the other guy might whip a gun out and wave it around in a show of bravado. But no one's supposed to actually shoot each other because when he first whips this gun out, he's just waving it around, right? If he wanted to shoot the security guard, he had the chance to do that. And I think he's really surprised when the guard takes his gun out and puts the muzzle on him. That's not supposed to happen. Those aren't the rules in his community, because he actually says, really? You're going to point the gun at me? I mean, listen to it right here.
I mean, who the fuck are you talking to, dog? Like, really?
Yeah, really. You're about to get shot a lot. So we have this fusillade of fire. The bad guy goes down right away. Now he's laying on, I think he shoots right there. I think it's the gunshot that hit the security guard. He's down on his back, and the guard just keeps shooting him. And there's a little pause, and then the guard shoots him again after the guy says, really, again? I'll play it again. It's funny.
Oh! Oh, God! Really?
Yeah, really. And then he gets shot again, even after that pause. So people can get in trouble for, you know, using defensive force lawfully. Then there's a pause in the action, and they shoot again. They can get in trouble for that later shot. If during the pause in the action, the threat was in fact neutralized and the defender should have seen the threat was neutralized. The trouble here for this trespasser, what almost certainly makes every one of these rounds fired by the security guard lawful, is that the trespasser never gives up his gun. He never drops the gun. He still has it in his hand right here after he says, really. And we know from common sense, we know that you might have shot someone and they're on the ground, but as long as they have that gun in their hand, they're still a threat. And in fact, we know in this particular case, as a matter of fact, the trespasser was still a threat because he shot the security guard after he was on the ground. After he was shot to the ground, he managed to point his gun at the security guard and hit him in the leg, which could just as easily have been in the chest or in the head. So in this case, after this pause, he still has his gun in his hand. So the security guard's perceiving that, still an imminent danger to the guard, arguably to others, customers, even out there in the parking lot. And the guard fires that last couple of shots. And as one might expect, yeah, that's blood in the doorway there. That's why I didn't play it for the live stream, the public stream. It's still moving. And there it looks like the gun finally gets dropped. It looks like right there. And after that, there's no more shots. Let's play it. Well, that was the last shot right then when the gun was lost at the last second. All right. So I would suggest a strong argument here that every one of those shots, even though it's a lot of shots, right? And I do caution, you want to use the minimal amount of force you can, consistent with safety. And here I think that was consistent with safety because the bad guy never gave up his gun. So let's go back and take a look at the member questions again. See if there's anything new on this little video. It must have hurt, right? I mean, that can't feel good. Let's see. Shotguns put a lot of holes in people. Shotguns are devastating at any kind of reasonable distance, like here. They're much less convenient to carry than a pistol, which is why people typically carry pistols. What double aught buckshot is 9.30 caliber balls. So what's the cliche? Pistols put holes in people. Rifles put holes through people. Shotguns take parts off of people. And they do. They do. It's a good experiment. If you ever have an opportunity, I've seen this at numerous training courses where they'll take like a pork shoulder and just shoot it with some double-aught buckshot. And the damage is unbelievable. Let's see. Yeah, I never saw him stop being a threat until the last second of that video. Let's see. Yeah, the guard did get shot in the leg, so he got hit. So arguably he wasn't getting good enough hits. I mean, it sounded like the guard, if we assume the bad guy shot twice, there was a lot of shots there, even if we subtract two. Clint Smith said that, yeah, shotguns take parts off people. That must be where I first heard it. He's a wealth of little cliches like that. Zakuza says the prosecutor MO on this would be wrong gun, wrong bullets, wrong number of shots. Yeah, if they wanted to prosecute, those are the arguments they would make. Kent says Scotty Wright took a perp's arm off with a 12 gauge. I 100% believe it. 100%. The trouble with shotguns is, and I know if you're a sizable guy, you're going to say that's not that bad, but they have the 12 gauge is substantial recoil for a smaller person. They do take some skill to use. I mean, they're not just blunderbuss weapons. The even double-aught buck doesn't spread as much as many people think. You do need to aim the things. If you're using a pump, I love pumps, but they take skill to use with proficiency. So not perfect, but devastating in the appropriate application. All right, let's see. Yeah, I think the bad guy's presentation of his pistol was really supposed to be some kind of bravado or deterrent or show of force, and he was shocked. I think when he found himself becoming a backstop. Let's see. All right, I think I got everyone's substantive questions. All right, folks, I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up. It's been about an hour since we started. Just remind all you law self-defense members, that's all of you who are left now on the show, just remind all of you, if you haven't taken this class yet, you're crazy, crazy. And today you can still get it for half off. We're going to send out an email later, right after the show, informing everybody today's last day for the 50% discount. But I should say up to 50%. I guess that's the proper terminology. But if you haven't taken this class yet, you're in the comments, folks. Members are in the comments. Tell everybody if this is a class worth taking, a day spent with attorney Andrew Brink. I know it sounds crazy. Who wants to hear a lawyer talk for a day? But we have many, many people, too, who've taken this class multiple times. 4, 5, 6 times is not unusual. And they keep learning more because it is a fire hose of information. But if you haven't taken it yet, this would be a good opportunity. lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. And with that said, I'll just remind all of you, if you carry a gun so you're hard to kill, that's why I carry a gun so I'm hard to kill, so my family is hard to kill. Then you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law so you're hard to convict as well. Win that legal fight as well as the physical fight. So until next time, I remain attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.